So if you're new with us here today, or you've been away for a while, we've actually been doing a series called Emotionally Healthy Spirituality, and we've been tracking through a number of topics. We've looked at the problem of emotionally unhealthy spirituality, knowing yourself that you may know God, going back to go forward, journey through the wall, enlarging your soul through grief and loss last week. And then today, I want to look at, as we wrap this series up, how do we grow into being emotionally mature adults? Because this is the whole point of the whole course. This is what the whole series has been about. Pete Scazzero has this byline, which you can see here. It's impossible to be spiritually mature while remaining emotionally immature. And what it means is that people can have all the Bible knowledge in the world, right? Some people can memorize whole books of the Bible, you know, have all this deep scripture inside them, yet they can also be anxious, immature, and defensive people as well, eh? Have you experienced that? This is true, eh? We can have a level of knowledge, but there hasn't been a spiritual and emotional development in us that we have that maturity in Christ. And I've said this before, and it comes out of the book, we don't want to be one-year-old Christians 21 times over, right? You know, you come to faith, you become a Christian, and you want to grow. You don't want to be staying in that same place you were when you first gave your heart to the Lord. You want to see God move in you and grow you. I do. I don't want to be the same I am now in 10 or 20 years. Thank God he's moved me on from when I was in my 20s, but there's growth and life that God wants to give us all. And you probably, you know, I realize we've kind of touched on some pretty heavy stuff here. And I just want to say, you guys are awesome, because this is some of the hardest stuff in life, like grief and loss, looking at our family of origin, looking at our feelings. Ooh, is that going on within me? Like this stuff, it doesn't feel great, does it? But there's actually something, there's life in that. And it's like, if you look at the cross, we're coming up to Easter. Jesus went to the cross. He could have jumped down off the cross, or he could have numbed the pain, but he went through the pain and suffering through to resurrection life. And as we bring these things of our lives up before the Holy Spirit, sometimes it's painful, sometimes it's hard. But God is asking us to journey through that, because there's resurrection life for us. Abundant life. Not just ordinary, trying to struggle, get through life. Abundant life is there for us. But it requires us to bring our stuff before the Lord and let him do a deep, deep work in us. And it's true of anything in life. The hardest stuff in life is usually the most important, right? And one thing I noticed about all this is that, I guess one of the temptations when you're listening along to this stuff is you can kind of think, is this just Christian self-help? And I think if you just left it at just dealing with your own stuff, it could be, you know, project self-help, you do you, Christian mindfulness or something like that. But actually the reason why we do all this stuff, the big why behind it, is for the sake of others. We want to be transformed by the love of God so that we can carry that love to other people. That is the whole point of this. It's said that the church is the only institution that exists for the sake of others. And that's who we are meant to be, Kurimako. We're meant to be transformed into his image and his likeness, to be like him for the world, for others. That is what he's calling each and every single one of you to today. And I guess the thing I've noticed is that when you go to funerals, normally the family and friends are not listing off achievements. They do a little bit, but mostly if you go to funerals, people are telling you what that person was like, right? They're telling you about that person's character, that the wonderful things that they did for their friends and family, how they gave of themselves. And most people, I think, living life, because we don't think about death, most of us kind of live for our CV, the list of achievements that we've got. Oh, I can do this, I can do that. But most of us don't live for our eulogy. We don't live for that moment when people are going to share about us and say, man, that guy, Bob, he was awesome. He was so kind. He was so caring. He did this for these people. He exuded the love of God. What a legacy that would be in our lives. Don't you want that? You can't, folks, you can't take your possessions and the achievements and all that stuff with you. This is what's going to be there at the end of your life, is the person that you became. Dallas Willard said it like this: the most important thing in your life is not what you do, it's who you become. That is what you will take into eternity. Isn't that beautiful? That what we're doing in this life actually matters. And the person that we're becoming actually matters, because we're going to continue this for all of eternity. And we can start right now growing in the love of God, becoming more like Jesus, to take that into eternity. What a wonderful thing to bring into eternity. Now there's grace, you know. The train stops at every station. You know, like if you haven't been living like this and you want to live like this, God's like, yes. And God always meets us where we're at, right? But he doesn't want us to stay there. God's got a plan for your life to grow and to flourish. He doesn't want you to stagnate or to drift or to fall back. You know who has that for your life? It's the enemy, the devil. He has a plan for your life, which is to basically distract you and discourage you into spiritual oblivion. Folks, some of the two biggest resistance that we will probably have as Christians is one, our personal time with God, and two, resistance to community, to church, and to the kingdom. You know, like when you're lying in bed, because I think sometimes we think of the devil, we think of a pitchfork and all that, you know, that's cartoons, guys. The devil is like when the alarm goes off in the morning and you're like, oh, I should get up and spend some time with God. And you're like, oh, but it's so nice and warm in here, isn't it? You know, like, oh, it won't matter. Just start again tomorrow. Like, that's how the devil works. He works through suggestion and distraction. And same with community and church, because the reality is church isn't always perfect and things don't always go right. And the devil's in here, oh, nah, don't go there. Why don't you just, the cafe's looking pretty good across the road. They got some good coffee, they got some good muffins over there. Oh, the beach will be nice today. You don't need to go there. Or home group, oh man, I'm just so tired. I just need a night off. There is something about intentionality, right? Intentionally spending time with God and intentionally being in community. And they will be the two biggest resistance things that you will face in your Christian life. And you've got to push in with God and community. That's where life is. That's how we grow. And in that passage I read out earlier, some of the teachers were trying to trap Jesus about what was the greatest commandment. And Jesus replied with this: love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. All of this, the law and the prophets, what was their Bible, the Old Testament, boils down to this. All of it hangs on this. Guys, this is what it's all about. It's all about loving God and loving others. And I sort of saw this recently and I didn't think about it. There's also an implication there to love yourself as well. Love your neighbor as yourself. Because we are so hard on ourselves, right? We beat ourselves up. We help the devil out because we're beating ourselves up at the same time. And there's a thing like, you know, when you're on planes and they instruct people to put your oxygen mask on first. The reason why they do that is because you're not going to be much help to your kids or to other people if you're passed out. You need to receive that life, that air, be filled up so that you can help others. And that's what's happening here. We go into the presence of God so that we can be filled up with his love and his life, so that we can be a great person to other people. Because if we're not full of all that stuff, we're not going to be able to exude a lot of love. We're going to just exude a lot of maybe defensiveness or bitterness or unforgiveness. That's not going to bring people to life. They want to see the love that's in us. It's said that people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. You've got to become a person of love, and this is the point of our lives. This is actually our vision as a church, a whānau who love Jesus, love one another, and want to see God's kingdom expand in the Manawatū and beyond. Like, I think it's only pastors that get really excited about a room full of a whole lot of people. I think most people just want to find a community of love where they can grow and develop. And, you know, for me, numerical growth, you know, yeah, it's important. Like, if it's just me and Amy and a cat and the kids or something, we'll wind this thing up. But it's not the main focus, right? Because my main focus and my heart for this church is that we are a place of love, of transformation, of growth, that people can say, I'm growing in God. I'm seeing Him do deep work within me, and I'm able to give that love to others, to my family, to my friends, to my neighbors, in my workplace. It's so good what's happening here. And the numerical growth is just a byproduct of that, because people are always attracted to life. When something's flourishing, people want to be a part of it. But it's not the main goal. It is a byproduct of abiding in Jesus, right? So that's our vision as a church. John Wesley called this process of growing God's love, being perfected in love. And Wesley described this as habitually filled with the love of God and neighbor, and as having the mind of Christ and walking as He walked. Isn't that beautiful? And so when he's talking there about maturity, when he's talking there about perfection, he doesn't mean that we will never sin, that we will never be tempted, that we won't make mistakes. What he's saying is that we will become mature. We will become like Jesus and do what He did. That's the dream, Korimako, that we would become a church filled with people who are perfected in love. What a legacy that would be for the city and for the Manawatū. And the two ways we're going to do that is from that passage. The first one is practice of the presence of God. Do you just want to click ahead? One, thanks, Johnny. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind. We've got to spend time with God. This is a lost thing. Like, I'd say in the older generations, people were really good at having a quiet time. It was something that was discipled into people, that they would get up every morning, they'd get their Bible out, they'd get their journal, they would have a series of prayers or something that they did, and they would consistently do that. But man, from my generation down, that has been lost, particularly in the charismatic and Pentecostal circles, because we love spontaneity. But the problem is when you're feeling awesome on Sunday and then you get to Tuesday and you're feeling like not motivated to get out of bed, you're going to need some discipline. Need some habit formation to help you to get up and be in the presence of God. And sometimes it's not going to feel awesome, but God is doing something to you. It's a bit like with the plants, when you have the roots and you're watering it, you can't see what's happening under the surface as you're watering those roots, right? But there's life, there's growth happening. The tree is growing, and it's sometimes so slow that we just do not see it. But God is doing something, even when we're sitting there in that time when we think, oh, this is boring, or I'm distracted, many thoughts. God is doing something in me. And if you can't pray for an hour, don't. It will probably break you if you do. Pray for 10 minutes. If you can't pray for 10 minutes, pray for 5 minutes. If you can't do that, pray for 1 minute. Make it so easy you can't fail. And, you know, you don't have to make your prayers complicated. Most of it is just sitting in the presence of God and letting Him love you and receiving that love and loving Him back. That might just be putting a 2-minute timer on your phone and sitting in silence of God. It might be just putting some worship music on. It might be just praying in tongues for a few minutes. It might be just sitting there reading through a psalm and just praying it back to the Lord. It doesn't have to be complicated, but there is a deep, deep work that God does when we're in that space. And so as a church, we're going to keep going on about this. We're going to keep banging the drum about you've got to have a devotional life. You've got to have a deep devotional life, because it's so powerful what God can do in that. And so I encourage you, if you need resources or you want help with that, please let us know. There's lots of great apps, there's lots of great resources and things that can help you build a deep devotional life. We have a men's group on Thursday mornings. We meet at a Cafe Jacko at 7 a.m. And every week, like an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, we go around and we share how our devotional life is. And I can tell you as a pastor, man, it can make you feel like a hypocrite sometimes. Because I'm having to share, oh man, this week hasn't been good, or it's been a bit wobbly. And then, you know what we do? We share, and then we encourage each other and say, keep going, get back on the wagon. Because that's what we're doing as a church, spending time in God's presence, because it's so powerful and it's so good. And then we just need to, the next step is, next slide, practice the presence of people. You need both of these things. These are the two counterformative practices to stop that resistance that we feel. It's not just about God and me. It's God and me and us. We are a church. We're a body. And so we need each other. This is so important, guys. I think sometimes we just think, oh, I'm just turning up to church on Sunday. I'm just singing some songs. I'm just taking communion, I'm listening to some notices, I'm listening to Nick prattle on. Like, we just think nothing's happening. Stuff's happening, guys. There is a spiritual realm, and we are doing things. It's like a spiritual declaration every time you turn up here, you stand in worship, you take communion, you listen to the word of God. God is doing something in you as you do that. And as you talk, you know, a spiritual practice of church is the cup of tea afterwards as well. It's the conversations, eh? It's the building of relational links. And same with going to home group or catching up with people, prayer groups, these things. There's stuff that God is doing in and through us that can only happen through community. It's not Project Solo. That's not going to transform our life. It's part of the equation, and that's with God anyway. It's not solo. It's both and. We need both and it's so important. But I think sometimes, you know, like you can read this passage and you can hear sort of talks around this stuff about, yeah, we want to be loving people. The point of our lives is to be loving. But I think sometimes we think, how the heck do you actually do that? And how do you actually become a person like that? Because it sort of seems like an idealistic thing, right? But we have to live in reality. And I love that in this passage, straight after that, when that Pharisee said to him, you know, who is my neighbor? You know, trying to catch Jesus out kind of thing. Jesus gives him a super practical story of the Good Samaritan, love in action, right there. And not just love in action with like an easy situation. Here was a situation where a guy who was completely opposite, and he was helping out the other who was completely opposite of him. Shocking story to them in their day that a Jew would help out a Samaritan. It's a beautiful story because it's showing love in action. Not love in a dream or some sort of ethereal thing. It's love grounded right out, day-to-day relationship. It's beautiful. It's what God is calling us to do as we grow as a church and as people, is to have that maturity. Now, Pete, he quite helpfully in his book sets out some markers of different emotional development. And I'll save you the emotional infant and child and adolescent. I think on some of my worst days, I'm probably somewhere between a child or an adolescent in my development. I'll give you these categories that he gave for what is a good, you know, mature emotional adult look like. Basically, a person who's allowed God to do the deep work in them, so that they are a person of love. So we're just gonna go through these quickly. First one, Johnny. Grow into an emotional adult. One, a mature person is able to ask for what they need, want, or prefer clearly, directly, and honestly. Have you heard of this thing called pretend agreements? So sometimes people ask you to do something, and you don't really want to do it. And they're like, oh, can you do it? Can you do it? And you're like, yeah. And then you're like, oh, man, I hate doing this thing, or I don't want to do this thing for people. But they're like, is it all good? Yeah, it's all good. And you've got this pretend agreement, like you're not actually happy about it, but you're doing it. But it's not good. And it's basically, if you're a people pleaser, and I'm one of these people, I struggle with this too, I'm working on it, you have a need for harmony. So you don't want to disrupt that. So you create this false peace by agreeing to something that you don't really want to do. Now, I did this to disastrous effects one time. In Christchurch, we lived by airport. And because we lived by the airport, people used to always ask us to come pick them up. And I didn't mind doing it. I sort of did it. But I had this one friend just keep getting me to pick him up all the time. And it actually didn't work for me some of the time. But I'd do it, kind of smiling, but begrudgingly as well. And one time I was getting so annoyed about this because I had to do it because he'd asked me to come do this thing, that I sent a text, I think, to Amy, and I actually was complaining about, oh, I've got to go pick these people. I don't want to do this. I'm busy. And that text went to my very friend. Has anyone else had that experience? So I learned a very valuable lesson with texting. Never write something like that down, like in an email or text. Always keep it off the books. But yes, grace of God in that situation. This guy is a very gracious person, and we end up having a beer and sorting it out. But that was because I didn't have that emotional maturity to say, actually, I'm at work. I can't come. This is going to put a lot of stress in my life. And he would have been totally fine with that. He said that too when we had a bit of a debrief. But I just didn't have the emotional maturity to be able to be clear about that. Brené Brown has this great line, to be clear is to be kind. And I have so learnt that as a leader, and I've been jobs and with people and with kids and all these things. Oh, ambiguity does not help. Being clear is to be kind and to say what's really going on. Now, you don't need to be a dork about this. You don't need to be super blunt and all that thing. You can be kind and gracious. But there is something good about just saying, yeah, that doesn't work for me, or I can't do that. You know, people are more gracious than we think. Second one, recognize, manage, and take responsibility for your own thoughts and feelings. Sometimes I think we have just no idea what's going on under here. And I have this funny thing where sometimes if I've had a really crazy day and I've got a lot of stuff going on, I'm stressed about stuff, I'll come home. And either if I'm being really intentional, I'll instigate this, or if Amy can see I need to do this, she'll say, go have a shower. And so I go and have a shower, and it's this kind of, it's like I find it for me, it's this thing where I stand in the shower and I've got all these things swirling around in my head about some conversation or some email or some thought or feeling that I got, and I just start sort of discerning what's going on within me. David has, in one of the Psalms, says, you know, why are you downcast, my soul? Why are you in turmoil within me? You know what he's doing there? He's discerning his feelings. Like, why do I feel like that? Why? And you might have that too. You might have, why did that person at the office look at me like that? That was a weird look. They've got a thing against me. What's that about? Why did they send that curt email? Oh. You know, we're great on passive aggressive in our culture, so we're always picking these things up, and we're like, what's going on with me? And do you know what I find? Like, most of the times I'm in the shower, I think it's just because it's a space with no technology, the water's on, I'm in this space where I pause. I find I just tend to work out what's going on. Oh, it's about that. Oh, that's what I'm really upset about. And sometimes I even just filter it like, oh, that's nothing, and I just let it wash away with the water. And then, you know, I feel better after it. And maybe you do that in different ways. Maybe you need to have a cup of tea. Maybe you need to go for a walk. Sometimes you might be hangry. Anyone else here? And you just get something good to eat, and you're like, oh, okay. Oh, I've got some perspective now. The blood sugars have come down. Like, this makes sense. But sometimes we just do not know what's actually going on within us, and so we need to discern our feelings like that. And that's so important, because I think often if we're not doing that, we'll build up and then it will come out in a really bad way that can cause a lot of damage. So it's so important to be working on your feelings and thoughts, like, what is going on within me? Why do I feel like that? And just bringing it to God and letting him work on it. Third one, can, when under stress, state their own beliefs and values without becoming adversarial? Oh man, this is the one for 2024, isn't it? The world we live in, with social media and angry people. There just seems to be so many things people are upset and triggered about these days. You know, some of them have got real legitimate reasons, but it just seems like people are so angry, so upset. And I even find, just even conversations, like it's like it's very hard to just be present with someone, to share what you think and believe without it turning into an argument, that they can see your view and you can see theirs, and it doesn't have to get adversarial. And I think sometimes this adversarial thing that we have in our society is not a good thing. Because I love this thing from Augustine. He says, in the essentials, unity, in the non-essentials, liberty, and all things, love. Guys, there's some essential things. Like, if you're telling me there's the fourth member of the Trinity, hey, we're gonna have a discussion there. But if you're just telling me that you think communion is merely symbolic, or you think something else is happening there, that's a non-essential. That's not an essential thing to our Orthodox faith, some of our views on communion. But if you think that Jesus Christ was just a man and he didn't die and rose again, that's an essential matter. But I love Augustine there, but in all things love, right? In all things love. All right, next one. Respect others without having to change them. Have you heard of this term, rescuers? So it comes out of a good heart. People often see in situations, parents can do this, friends can do this. You see someone who is struggling with something, they need help. It's obviously a need they have in their life, whatever it is, and you rush in and help that person. Now, the help part's great. The support part's great. The encouragement is awesome. But what often happens is that you're trying to fix that person. You're trying to, in a sense, you're actually taking that agency, their personal agency, and you're sort of taking over to try and help them. But they're not going to grow through that experience because you're taking away the consequences, or you're taking away their opportunity to grow. If you experience this, and it always comes out of a good heart. It's not a terrible thing. But if you don't let people have personal agency, and remember that we don't actually transform people, God does. So as Christians, our role is to get alongside people and to help them find the source of life, the water. But they've got to take the water themselves. They've got to receive it themselves. They've got to let that go into their lives. We can't do it for you. You cannot drink the water for them. They need to take it themselves. And you can pray for them. You can encourage them. You can support them. You can do all of these things. But they have to engage in that themselves. And so sometimes we try and fix people. But we just need to let God do what only He can do, right? Next one. Give people room to make mistakes and not be perfect. I won't make people put hands up. Any perfectionists in the room? Yeah. I'm not one of those. So this is actually not something I struggle with, but I'll probably frustrate you if you're a perfectionist. If you are a perfectionist, life is going to frustrate you, right? Because life is full of unfinished symphonies. Like, there are so many things that are not perfect and not going to be perfect in this lifetime. They will be eternally, but in this moment, it's not going to be. And so people will push your buttons if you are wired that way. And so you have to develop grace if you're one of those sort of people. You have to be like, man, I would really like this to be this way, but it's about 80% right, so that's good. I've got grace for you in this situation or what's happening here, because you're another human being who God loves as well. Next one. Oh, next one, Johnny. Appreciate people for who they are, the good, the bad, and the ugly. That's not about looks. I think that's about behavior. Not for what they can do for you. We are all created in the image of God. You know that person that you cannot stand? Created in the image of God. You know that angry neighbor? Created in the image of God. You know that person you don't like who's a politician or celebrity or whoever it is? Created in the image of God. We are all created in the image of a good and loving Father. But somehow, we lose that. And I think the thing is, I understand that as humans, we love to hang out with people who are like us. And even churches can be like this too. So you get churches that have a demographic kind of spread that's kind of similar to probably the pastor or something like this. And man, I've thought about this too. Like, genuinely in life, I'd probably like to have people who love cricket, rugby, coffee, tramping, craft beer, I don't know, whiskey or something. Like, that would be fun for a while. Like, we'd be like, yeah, this is awesome. Yeah, no, this is awesome. No, this is awesome. Yeah, this is awesome. Oh, this is awesome. You know, like, and maybe into, like, personal affirmation as well. So we're just telling each other how awesome we are. Like, that kind of thing. Like, it'd be great for a while. But then it would just get boring, right? Because that's not a church, or that's just a club where people come around the same interests kind of thing. And I think Eugene Peterson said, you're not really running a, you know, no, you're not really got a true church until you've got a whole lot of people there who you probably wouldn't normally hang out in everyday life as well. Like, a church should be the most diverse group of people that we have in society. It should draw on all sorts of people, different political thoughts, different socioeconomic ethnicities. Like, we are this melting pot of God's new humanity, and God is doing something in and through us as we gather together, all created in the image of God. And that means we all have intrinsic value and worth, every single one of us. That is good news, isn't it? What a message to the world. We all have intrinsic value and worth. Okay, next one. This has been a biggie for me sometimes. Accurately assess their own limits, strengths, and weaknesses, and able to freely discuss them with others. I've talked about this before. It's actually a gift to work out that you've got limits. When I was in my 20s, I just thought I was kind of limitless. Like, well, I could do everything. I could go anywhere and do this. And now in my 40s with teenagers, I'm like, oh, man, I'm just, my life's so limited. Sometimes I feel like Han Solo and he's in the, and Luke, and they're in that garbage disposal thing, and the thing's all like pressing together, kind of in Star Wars, like, oh, the pressures of life, you know. Like, I've realized in my 40s how much limits I have, and I've worked out that I have strengths and I have weaknesses. As Paul, he's one of the trustees, can attest and does our accounts, administration is not my strength, is it, Paul? Much to his, Nick, please stay out, don't do that. it's just not a strength of mine. I'm not super great at organizing things. I've got an amazing wife that is. But it's not a strength of mine. But I can do this. I have no problem standing up in front of people, casting vision and preaching the word of God. I've got other strengths and stuff like that. And it is such a gift, whoever you are, to work out who you are. Augustine said, "No, grant, Lord, that I may know myself, that I might know thee." Like, that is the prayer of our lives. And most of our lives is working that out. So I encourage you, if you're trying to work out how you're wired, there's lots of great tools out there. There's Myers-Briggs personality tests, strength finders, Enneagram. There's all these sort of things that can work out, oh, okay, that's why I'm wired that way. That's why I do those things like that. And it is such a gift to be able to work out where your lane is, where your sweet spot is. Yeah, that's where I'm good. That's where I can do that. And then actually be able to say to people, hey, I can't do that. That's really out of my wheelhouse. Could you do that? Like, that is a gift to be able to work that out in life. Next one. This is the second to last. Are deeply in tune with their own emotional world and able to enter into the feelings, needs, and concerns of others without losing themselves. So this is the ability to be empathetic to people without their pain and their suffering and their circumstances crushing you. There's this thing that people who are in care kind of industries, like doctors, nurses, social workers, counselors, teachers, pastors, that sort of thing, they have this thing called compassion fatigue. And what that is that basically someone's listened to someone else's trauma, pain or suffering, and it's had a cumulative effect on it. Sometimes they call it vicarious trauma, because you have had to absorb that, and it's overwhelmed you, and it's, you know, it's taken you out kind of thing. And, like, we want to be compassionate. We want to be loving. We don't want to be stoic people who are just indifferent to people's circumstances and situations, but we don't want it to take us out. And Jesus is the perfect model of this. There's an interesting story from a child who goes missing, and they find him in the temple. And his mother says to him this, like most mums would say, "We have been anxiously searching for you." And he said, he just kind of gives this answer back like, "Oh, didn't you know I'd be in my dad's house? Didn't you know I'd be here in the temple?" He wasn't being rude to his mum and dad. He was just sort of stating who he was. He knew who he was even at the age of 10. He had a very clear understanding of who he was and his calling and his relationship with the Father. And he wasn't taking on his mother's anxiety. So often sometimes when people are anxious or upset, we, like reactive to things, we take on their reactivity. Sometimes it goes back in defensiveness, or we get, you know, feel overwhelmed with compassion with that person. But we actually, if we can be like Jesus, be that non-anxious presence, we can listen well, we can care for that person, but we can actually be able to be whole and it won't take us out. And then just the last one, Johnny. Have the capacity to resolve conflict maturely and negotiate solutions that consider the perspectives of others. As much as I don't like this, conflict is a part of life. It's part of church life. It's part of just being humans, that we will disagree, see things differently, and we can do that well, or we can do that really badly. And I think part of it is that we misinterpret sometimes what Jesus was doing. Jesus disrupted the false peace that was all around him. He disrupted the false peace with religious authorities, with his disciples, with the crowds. He was full of care and love and compassion, but he was bringing his kingdom, he was bringing his reality to the situation, because the world that they lived in needs it. Our world needs it. And I think sometimes we misinterpret from the Beatitudes, blessed are the peacemakers. I think sometimes we think blessed are the peacekeepers, and there's a massive difference between the two, right? A peacemaker is someone who is willing to resolve both outer and inner turmoil in order to establish peace with others and within themselves. A peacekeeper desires to maintain peace by avoiding conflict. They typically give in to the tension or steer clear of disagreement to keep others happy. I think that's a huge one in our culture. It's a massive one that many people struggle with. And there's a way to do it, conflict well, where you keep the love on and the compassion and the grace without all that terrible avoiding conflict. And then the thing that was about nothing becomes something, because we don't have the conversation, we don't clarify, we don't do Matthew 18, we don't just go talk to someone, and we pick up offense and then things go wrong. Like, this is huge, guys. You'll have this in your workplaces, you'll have this in your schools, you'll have this in your friendships, with your neighbours, you'll have it in church, you'll have it everywhere. Like, this is a huge part of life. And if you can pick up that skill to be a peacemaker and not a peacekeeper, it's going to help you immensely. I've come into close with this. There's this great verse from James, which I think is relevant to our crazy world we live in and for doing growing in maturity as Christians. James 1:19, be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. What a life verse, eh? I think every organization in the world should have that as their vision or statement. Be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. Like, I heard this thought experiment, and it said, like, would you like yourself if you met yourself somewhere? Like, just imagine that. Like, I'll use me, so you guys don't worry. Imagine if I'm walking to Cafe Cuba and there's Nick sitting there drinking a cup of coffee. Would Nick listen well to me? Would Nick be interested in my life? Would he show love and compassion? Like, think about yourself and think about how we do that. It's so often said that around conversations that most people are not listening. They're just waiting for their turn to be heard. And I love this. Go to the next picture, Johnny. Yes, St. Nick, actually. it actually is. have you ever seen these icon pictures? They're from the early church. They're kind of somber-looking things, but there's actually a lot of beauty of them. If you can just go back one, Johnny. There's actually a lot of beauty if you can pay attention to some of the details. So have you noticed in these pictures that they've got big ears and they've got really small mouths? Oh, it's one picture, so it's a mouth, singular. and the reason for that is not because the guy was making a joke or something about this. is that was something that was a virtue in their culture. That was someone who had big ears to listen to God and others, and a small mouth not to talk all the time. And I just think, man, I've got, this is one of my biggies in life. I when I'm listening to people, I just want to finish their conversations because they're not getting there fast enough. Does anyone struggle with that? I'm like, I'm already ahead of them. Like, it's an INFP thing, and I'm like, you hurry up, you're taking too long. I'm just going to finish this for you. And Amy loves it. You're not listening to me. I've never heard that in my marriage. But it is a critical tool, guys. I love this quote. I'm going to finish with this in a second. Being heard is so close to being loved that for the average person, they're almost indistinguishable. Have you experienced that in your life? When you had someone who gave you full attention, they weren't distracted by what was going on behind them, they weren't looking at their phone, they were just looking at you, giving you great eye contact, listening, maybe asking some really good deep questions, but just sitting there and waiting and letting you finish, not trying to finish your sentences or just wait till they could talk. It's such a gift, eh, in our society. And I kind of think this is the goal, whānau. This is what we're going after. And these things don't happen outside of the practice of the presence of God. Spending time with him on a daily basis and out of the practice of the presence of people. Spending time with each other, doing life together. This together will help us to grow into people of love that can impact our workplaces, schools and neighbourhoods. Imagine if you were that kind of person in the workplace. When everyone's getting stressed and freaking out and complaining, critiquing things, you're that non-anxious presence of love. People are going to be like, what is it about that person? I want to know what is it about them that is so different. That is the most powerful form of evangelism in our culture. That is the most powerful way we're going to reach people's hearts, is that we live in a different way from the world. It's a way of love that the world desperately needs. Let's stand. Kori mako. One of the greatest gifts we can give our city is to be a whānau of emotionally healthy adults who love well. Man, I would love that is the legacy of this church for the next 30 or 40 years or whatever it's going to be, that we would be known as a deep community marked by his love. But that's easier said than done. But be encouraged by this from what Jesus did. Jesus formed a community of people who are neither spiritually or emotionally mature. Peter had a big problem with his mouth and a bundle of contradictions. Andrew, his brother, was quiet and behind the scenes. James and John were given the name Sons of Thunder because they were aggressive, hot-headed, ambitious, and intolerant. Philip was skeptical and negative. Nathaniel and Bartholomew were prejudiced and opinionated. Matthew was the most hated person in Capernaum because he was a tax collector. Thomas was pessimistic. James, son of Alphaeus, and Judas, the other Judas, son of James, were nobodies. We don't actually really know much about them. Simon the Zealot was a freedom fighter and a terrorist. Judas was a thief and a loner. He pretended to be loyal to Jesus before finally betraying him. Most of them, however, did have one great quality. They were willing. And that is all God asks of us.